Welcome back to Understanding Autism. I'm Paul Loudon. I'm here in Phoenix, Arizona with my co-host, Kim Isaac. I am a 31-year-old adult on the autism spectrum, and I've joined this show to talk about my experiences as a person who lives life every day through the lens of autism.
And I'm Kim Isaac, and I am an autism specialist and a certified relationship development intervention consultant. And as Paul said, we're here to help you understand autism. And today's show, actually, we have a really great show, something we've never done before, which is a question and answer show. So we're going to be answering questions. Some of these questions are just from, you know, some of them are just sort of common questions from people who may not know anything about autism, and also some from people actually on the spectrum and some from parents. So I'm excited. We have two sections. We have a section of questions that are just for Paul, and then we have a section of sort of general questions. I thought that we would go back and forth and share our thoughts. So I'm going to dive in and start with a Paul question. Okay. So, Paul, somebody wants to know what the hardest thing about having autism is for you.
The hardest thing about having autism for me is knowing that I'll never know what it's like not to have autism. That, you know, even if I overcome all the symptoms, even if I manage to raise my quality of life to a level where I'm comfortable and I'm not struggling with the things that I struggle with now, I still won't know what the difference is. There'll still always be that question for me of, you know, how does everyone else experience the world? What are they seeing? Are there things that they're still getting that I don't get? What's life like without having to spend so much time sort of fighting against your own brain and against your own limitations that other people just don't have to experience? So, you know, I know that sounds really negative, but the question is, what is the hardest thing? That's sort of what it is, that even knowing that, you know, things do get better, even knowing that I can address a lot of these challenges, there's still always going to be that question.
That's a really, I know it does sort of sound like a negative, but as you said, the hardest thing was what was asked. But I also think it's a very, you know, important answer. It's a very honest answer, and I'm sure a lot of, you know, other people out there, you know, might be feeling that. And sometimes some people just like to know that they're not the only one thinking or feeling that. So so that's thank you for sharing that one. That's a hard one, I would imagine, to even answer at all. But
fortunately, I've been asked it before, so I've had time to think about it for a while.
Okay. So I'm going to actually jump into the pool here of a general question, which is somebody wants to know, how common is autism?
And that's a tough one to answer, just because we have statistics. Right now, they're saying, what, 1 in 88 is the diagnosis rate in the U.S., but in some countries it's lower, in some countries it's higher. The DSM just changed, though I read that with the DSM change, when you take autism, Asperger's, and PDD and OS from the old one, and when you take autism and, was it social communication disorder?
Right.
When you take the incidence of those, that they're about equal. So that the DSM change didn't really affect the diagnosis rate. It just sort of reshuffled a little bit where they may lie. But it is a really hard one to answer because, you know, there's a difference between how common is autism and how common is autism diagnosed. You know,
and also how common or how often it's reported.
Yeah.
I actually have some comments about that too, because it was interesting to know that, I mean, that's going to get into another answer to a question, so I better save that. But at present, yes, the current numbers that I read are 1 in 88. And not that long ago, in the 60s and 70s, it was like 1 in 10,000. And so now that we have better diagnostic criteria, you know, we're able to understand better what we're seeing and clarify out symptoms, you know, we're able to more accurately diagnose. So, and
but again, that diagnosis is not the same as how common is autism. And that's, you know, there are still probably, you know, millions of people out there with undiagnosed autism. Not just among adults, the people who were born too early to have a good chance of being diagnosed, but among those who are young enough to be diagnosed, but because of the situation they grew up, the country they grew up, or even just, you know, even if they grew up everywhere right, just because no one noticed it, thought they were maybe just shy or whatever, that autism is almost certainly a higher rate than the 1 in 88 that's being diagnosed. And it's just one of those things that it's out there, and you probably meet several people with autism every week, and you don't even know it.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, 3 out of every 4 people diagnosed are male, and so that's something that people sometimes ask me about related to that question is, so it's more prevalent in males than females.
And, well, no, it's more diagnosed in males than females.
Diagnosed.
Because, again, you know, in terms of autism diagnosis, we're still pretty early on. We diagnose it by symptoms. We don't have a blood test or a scan or anything like that. So it's entirely possible that it's at similar rates in women, but the symptoms are harder to spot just because of cultural upbringing, that we teach women to act a certain way, and a lot of the ways that we teach them to act sort of cover up a lot of the symptoms for higher functioning autism, especially.
That's a good
point. So we don't know. None of the rates that we've got are concrete. We just know what the current estimated diagnosis is, and that's 1 in 88, with 3/4 of them male.
Right. Okay, let's move on to a Paul question. Paul, what has been something that people have done in your life to help you relate and understand interactions better?
And this is a tough one just because, you know, I go back and a lot of times I remember more when things fail than when things help. So it's very difficult for me to talk about things people have done that have really helped me relate better. But I think one thing, and we've talked about this an awful lot on the show, is the idea of talking about why. That what people have done that has helped me probably the most that I can remember is being willing to answer when I ask them why. Being willing to, you know, if they tell me something and I say, why do you feel that way? Not taking it as criticism, not saying that, you know, you shouldn't feel that way, but rather me trying to understand how they work and, you know, how to get along with them better. So being able to have that question why answered by people you trust and people you don't trust sometimes, just anyone who's willing to, and without judgment for asking that question why, is probably the single simplest in terms of, you know, direct action way that I feel like people can help me and other people on the spectrum who are in similar positions to what I'm in.
So I have sort of a little spin-off question of this one, but you said you sort of remember the fails easier than the things that help. What is there something that stands out, though, that definitely didn't help or made it harder for you that people have done?
Well, just in contrast is obviously the times where people won't tell me why, or it's really the assumptions that people make, that people often, you know, when you ask why, they're just like, well, you should just be able to figure it out or just do it. You know, that if I say, you know, why are you angry about this? And their response is, you know, well, you should be able to figure out why I'm angry about this, or, you know, how can you not be angry about this? That people are sort of often minimizing of the challenges that I run into for this sort of thing. So it's just the opposite, that, you know, that being willing to accept that why is a valid question is really important. For any question, why is a valid question?
Yeah, that's a good point. I wonder, you know, I was just thinking about for individuals on the spectrum, I know this is a question for you and you are able to, but I was just thinking from my experience, if you are working with someone who isn't able to speak and ask you why, a really good thing to do is to slow down and explain and give them, you know, a chance and just really adjust your pace. Because it's really important that when you have someone who can't communicate, you know, maybe they're completely confused or frustrated, you know, you want to leave the space for them to actually be able to keep up with you and have an opportunity to even maybe communicate nonverbally, you know, point to something or write something down. So it just sparked in my mind hearing Paul, who is able to talk about it. There are a lot of people out there who aren't able to talk about it, and sometimes for those individuals, things go very quickly, and so it's important to slow down and give them a chance to participate, you know, at the level that they can. So, okay, so here we have another question. What is autism? How would you describe autism in a simple way? Oh, the word simple and autism in the same sentence seems pretty hard, in the same question. Paul, how would you describe autism in a simple way?
In a simple way? I would describe autism as thinking in a different way. That when you talk about autism, a lot of times we talk about the symptoms, but a lot of it really comes down to how someone experiences the world. You know, whether lights are brighter or dimmer for them, whether things are more sensitive or less sensitive to them. That, you know, think about old TVs before all these digital flat panels. You would have a knob where you could adjust the picture, where, you know, the picture would be slid up or down a bit. You'd have a knob that could add more color or remove some color. You'd have a knob that adjusts brightness. And everyone can sort of adjust those knobs in their own head to get everything right in the picture. Someone with autism, those knobs are stuck. And part of knowing about autism is being able to interact with them and figure out whether the opposite knobs are turned one way or another way, and figure out ways where even with those stuck knobs, maybe some of them can be jiggled a little bit, some of them can't, or maybe, you know, you can still see the important part of the picture, you know, so figuring out where those knobs are stuck. So autism is sort of like a TV with the knobs jiggled wrong.
Oh, that's, I've never heard you describe it that way.
I just kind of came up with that right now.
On
so you put me on the spot, and I had to had to work with what we've got.
No, I think that's a really good. I mean, that's a really good example. I mean, the way I see it, again, the word "simple" in autism is, to me, it feels like there's not. I mean,
that's like how you describe quantum mechanics simply. I mean, it's not a simple
it's
thing.
It's not a simple thing. But a lot of times, you know, people on the spectrum, they have difficulty, you know, understanding social interactions, and they may not respond in ways we would expect someone to respond. So, you know, if you're out there, you know, maybe you know someone who maybe, you know, interacts with you a little bit differently than you're used to or would expect, that's a possibility that, you know, that they are seeing things differently, or they're not able to, you know, they're not filtering out what you're filtering out and getting the same meaning from the same situation. And so it's really, you know, two people sometimes just seeing things really differently, you know, and not intentionally to be, you know, not collaborative, but just because the brains are operating a little bit differently. And you might see people on the spectrum have a big one that people talk about a lot is nonverbal communication difficulties, understanding it and also using it. So that's just another thing. If you're interacting with someone, and again, the responses, whether it's verbal or nonverbal, aren't maybe what you expect, there's a chance that they just may be, you know, processing differently. Doesn't mean bad. It just means different. So, and also I would just, I guess, trying to keep simple bits, not like a simple one-sentence answer, but also just an awareness of other people and sometimes of themselves. So if you, you know, see people and maybe it looks like they're talking to themselves or doing some kind of repetitive, you know, behavior, a lot of times that they're just self-soothing, trying to keep themselves regulated or calm. That's kind of something that you would see as like a behavioral symptom of autism. It's not autism itself. But if you're, you know, someone out there that's just wondering what this might look like, sometimes you might see that too. So why don't we take a short break, and then when we come back, we'll continue questions and answers.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
At Beerenbaum and Spien PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Birenbaum and Spean works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
Ridenour, Heinten & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues, corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Ridenour, Heinten & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
Hello, I'm Jessica Olson, and I'm here to introduce you to someone whose job it is to stand together with you at the worst of times. Life throws us unexpected curveballs, including losing loved ones, caretaking, troubled retirements, job losses, and legal settlements. Meet certified financial planner Larry Moscat, who pioneered crisis financial counseling. With a background as a clinical psychology practitioner, Larry has helped numerous people see through their crises to a brighter financial future. Larry?
Thank you, Jessica. At our firm, RII Advisors in North Scottsdale, we know terrible times don't usually last, but the effects of anxiety-infused financial decisions can last a lifetime. For 30 years, our prime goal has been to introduce freedom from fear and a feeling of financial security for our clients. We then move forward with safety and best-case outcome results when it comes to the financial decisions made during the worst of times.
To learn more, log on to www.RIIAdvisors.com. That's RIIAdvisors.com for information on how to get help. Once again, that's RIIAdvisors.com for financial counseling during life's most challenging times.
Everybody, and welcome back. This is Understanding Autism. I'm Paul Loudon. I'm here with Kim Isaac, and we have with us Greg Isaac, head of the Breakthrough Thinking Content Network, which our show is a part of.
And it's actually Dave Isaac.
Dave Isaac. Oh,
that's okay.
Greg is usually running the show. You're usually talking with us.
Yes.
Dave Isaac.
It's a little different today.
I thought
today.
You were making a joke today.
No,
that's
I can't remember.
It was great. I appreciate that. But, yeah, Breakthrough Thinking Broadcasting Network live here at Regis Suites. And you guys are doing great. I love these questions.
We've been answering some questions from our audience about autism and about my experiences with autism and autism in general. So.
And, Kim, you got some more.
Yeah, we have some more questions. I'm going to go to a Paul question. Paul, we have someone who wants to know, what has your experience in adulthood in terms of adult responsibilities been like?
Rocky, to say the least. It's been a challenge. When I first graduated from high school, I didn't have an autism diagnosis, and so I attempted to do college on my own a few times and failed. I haven't attempted to go back to college or higher education at all since I've had my diagnosis. No, actually, I did try once. I experienced really poor students with disabilities program, and they didn't seem to know anything about autism. The only concession they could offer me was more time on tests, and that's pretty much the only concession I absolutely never need. I typically finish tests in half the allotted time or less. That's not my issue. So that didn't work out well, but the big challenge I've had since then, I do live on my own, is self-management and timing. One thing that happened to me a lot when I was living on my own is bills that I couldn't set up an automatic payment for, even when I had the money to pay them, often wouldn't get paid because I would tell myself, oh, I'll do it later, I'll do it later, I'll do it later, and then the deadline would pass, and then maybe I wouldn't have electricity. And then I'd go and pay it because there was the direct consequence. But I was very good at very ignoring those kinds of things. I was very bad at self-management activities. And I still even have a lot of challenges now in doing regular things like keeping the house clean. I tend to only do laundry when I'm on my last outfit. And that's a little bit of a guy thing, but it's also just, in a practical sense, every time that happens. But so the struggle has often been just sort of keeping up with regular things, making sure that I have food in the fridge, making sure that I have cat food, you know, things, everything like that. Every single one of those, no matter how important I mentally assign them an importance or not, I don't keep up with well. And I think that for people on the spectrum, it's going to be different what kind of challenges they have. I've met a lot of people on the autism spectrum who seem to be very organized, and they may have, I don't know, very structured schedules or something. But even when I try to structure the schedule, I end up feeling resistance to that structure, and I don't handle it well. So for me, the biggest challenge in an adult life living on my own has been this just basic idea of self-maintenance and motivation.
Okay, self-maintenance and motivation. Yeah, I'm wondering, I just don't know if you want to share about this, but because I know you, I think it's pretty interesting, is you found some tools, electronic type tools, to help you with some of that self-management. I know we're probably going to talk about those in other shows, but I don't know if you want to just give a little blurb about that, because that might be helpful for somebody listening.
Well, yeah, I mean, for me, just the biggest thing is I have an Android phone, so using Google Now and Google Calendar to set up reminders and appointments, and making sure that they're visible to me constantly, because the thing is there are often times where I have the energy to do something, but I don't remember that I have to do something. And then when I do see the reminder, I don't have the energy to do it. So when I put something like, don't forget to pay the bill for X, let's say pay the electricity bill or whatever, or phone bill, things like that. If I put a reminder on my phone that I see that phone bill due, every time I turn on my phone, I see a reminder that the phone bill is due 7 days from now, 5 days from now, whatever. One of those times when I turn on the phone, I'm going to be like, I don't have anything to do. I'll go ahead and get that out of the way. So even though I can't really motivate myself, my motivation fluctuates up and down. And having it in front of me all the time really helps me to keep it present in my mind until one of those times where I am motivated enough to get some things done. So I found that with Android now, with Google Glass especially, that having some means of keeping these appointments, these schedules, these things in front of my face in a way that is not an alarm going off saying, do this now, but rather a casual reminder saying, this is coming up, has really helped me to take control of some of the more important things that just absolutely have to get done.
Let me ask you this, Paul. Do you ever find yourself not enjoying these other tasks? Do you ever assign consequences, either positive or negative, to these tasks as a way of motivating?
I can't really connect with those kind of consequences. It doesn't work. You know, even, like I said, the power went out. I knew the power was going to go out. It went out, and then I paid the overage or reconnect fee, and then 3 months later, when it was too much overdue again, the power went out again, and then I did it again. Even though I knew pretty significant negative consequences were coming, it just wasn't something I could do because the method of paying the bill, I mean, I didn't like having to deal with mailing checks or going somewhere to pay it. As soon as I got electronic payments, it got easier, but especially having reminders. A lot of it was just that, I don't know, I don't like mail, but it drives me nuts that so many things still have to come in the mail, and I'm like, I'm not even going to see this unless, you know, I check mail like every 3 or 4 days at best, and even then I need something to remind me to do that.
Let's go from the opposite end, from rather than a negative consequence to a positive consequence. Rather than the power going off, what happens if the power stays on? Is there something that would be so important, so critical to you to have that power on, some amazing opportunity or some game that's just coming out? Would that be a motivating factor?
I really don't think so. I mean, like I said, it's power. It's I live on the internet. I'm basically, even then I would just not get it done until it was too late. And I mean, it's the same thing with like food around the house, you know. I'll have days where I'm like, I'm starving, but I just don't really feel up to going in and getting food. And so then I'll go like a day and a half without eating until I'm finally just too hungry not to. It really does happen that this motivational issue, even though I know I'll feel great after I get a good meal, doesn't matter. And so motivation has really been a significant one for me. And integrating a lot of modern technology into it has helped with a lot of these things. Some of them it doesn't help with, but a lot of these things it's really allowed me the opportunity to take advantage of the times where I am stronger to get things done.
With motivation, we haven't talked about it in a long time, but it might be helpful for listeners to know, is it something like your body feels like you just can't get at, like when you say motivation, do you mean just mental or just physical, like you can't move yourself?
There's nothing there to move me. I don't even know what you're asking.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I just wanted to ask in case somebody was curious about that. We have another question. Somebody wants to know if someone can catch autism or can it develop later on in life? And no, you cannot catch autism. You can be diagnosed later in life, meaning you've had it your whole life, but that doesn't mean you would have caught it.
Yeah.
It would have been there.
At the moment, there are no known, like, causes of autism that are, you know, you can be exposed to later in life and suddenly you'll have autism, or that, you know, there are cases where, like, maybe something that causes brain damage in general can cause autism-like symptoms, you know, that you know, maybe lead poisoning or something else could degrade certain faculties. But in a realistic sense, autism is a name for a developmental disorder that you have from birth or before, really, that is sometimes genetic, sometimes due to other causes, but it's not due to anything contagious. You can't, you know, be afflicted with autism by being around a bunch of autistic people. You may pick up some of their mannerisms in the same way that anyone will pick up mannerisms from people they spend too much time around, but that's just habits and things like that. Autism itself provides no danger to anyone around autistic people in any way.
That's a good way of answering. Why don't we take another short break, and when we come back, we will continue answering questions. And if you have any questions you want to throw at us at the last minute, you can post them on our Facebook. And we are going to be checking throughout the break. So if you go to facebook.com and then /Understanding Autism Radio, you can post your questions there, and we'd be happy to answer them.
Birenbaum and Spien PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Birenbaum and Spien works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
Ridenour, Heinsohn & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues, corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Ridenour, Heinsohn & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602 254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
Welcome back once again to Understanding Autism. We're now in the second half of our show answering some audience questions. I'm Paul Loudon. I'm here with Kim Isaac and Dave Isaac.
Yay! I made it to the big time. All right, here we are. And we're here live, Regis Suites. This is great. Phoenix, Arizona. I'm going to ask what I usually ask. The weather. It's just as good in Houston today, isn't it?
Today, yes. When I left, freezing. So hopefully it'll stay warm by the time I get back.
That's nice. Very, very cool. Okay, so these are really valuable questions for the listeners, and I don't think there's any other show that has a perspective like this where Paul has lived this his entire life and can offer valuable, invaluable experiences and description of what people are going through. And, Paul, we honor you for that. That's really fantastic.
I'm happy to talk about what I can.
Yes. All right, Kim, what do we got?
Well, we have another Paul question. This one, it reads, Paul, I'm an adult on the spectrum. I know that I may not be doing everything I'm supposed to be doing when interacting with others. I seem to get into many disagreements. Would it be a good idea to tell people that I have autism? Do you tell people that you have autism? When and how do you do it? That's a big one.
Yeah, and I think the answer for this one is going to be very personal, that it's going to depend an awful lot on your life situation and what kind of people you're talking about. I know that now I tell everyone I have autism because of what I do. But before this, and in the case of, say, my private life, I don't think I would tell people I have autism until I've given them a little bit of a chance to know me. Because I know that typically, most times, if I have disagreements with people, it's either going to be in a professional context that I'm having a disagreement with someone because they have a job, maybe it's the rental car person, and they're not handling it the way I think they should be handling it, and I need them to do something for me. And in those contexts, their knowledge of me having autism isn't going to make a big difference. In fact, it may make things worse anyway. So I typically, wouldn't walk up to the rental car stand and say, "Hi, I have autism and I have a reservation." But in my personal life with person-to-person, disagreements usually happen once you're a little bit close to someone, once you're ready to open up about maybe political beliefs or religious beliefs or something like that, or once you're ready to spend some time around each other and maybe depend on each other or something. Because disagreements usually happen when both sides care about something, even if it's just caring about whether you show up on time. And so they require typically a little bit of closeness. So I like to let someone get to know me before I tell them I have autism, because then they've seen that I'm a normal person and that I'm someone they can get along with. And then I say, "Look, we seem to be getting along pretty well. We're hanging out a lot. Just in case, I want to let you know that I am diagnosed on the autism spectrum, and I try to not let it get in the way, but there is a chance that bad things may occasionally happen, and I'd really, appreciate it if you try to keep this in mind in case something goes wrong. And I'll do my best to, but just, to let you know in advance." So to me, that's the way I'm comfortable doing it. I think that disclosure is typically really important because, one, we need to raise autism awareness, But two, we also need to raise awareness that people with autism are just people, that we struggle with autism, but it's still something that doesn't define who we are. It just defines some of the challenges that we struggle with in our day-to-day life. I'm left-handed, and I have a lot of challenges relating to that, but that doesn't define me as a person, and neither does autism. So I think disclosure is good, but timing it, and this can be very difficult, obviously, since autism can sort of make it hard to gauge how close you are with someone, but timing it has some value, too, and I think it may be better to err on the side of disclosing it early. I'd really typically prefer to try to make sure they know about it before anything goes wrong, rather than we're having an argument, and then I say, I'm sorry, I'm doing what I can, but I have autism. To a lot of people, that starts sounding like an excuse. And it can be really hard to get someone to sort of accept it as a real thing at that point. So I think early disclosure is probably best for anyone that you feel either you are close to or you have the chance to get close to and you want to be upfront about it.
Let me ask you this. Do you think – well, let me phrase it this way. Have you the experience of when you've disclosed it, like really early and really late and maybe in the middle? Has that happened in your life?
I've probably, at different times to different people just because, once I was diagnosed, I was 23. I had some friends that I'd known for, 10, 15
yeah.
years. Well, not 15 years, 10 years, who, then it's like, oh, okay, so it was new to them. And then at that time, a lot of times I wasn't really telling people about it. So I've sort of had the whole range of it.
I started wondering, based on that question, if you noticed any changes in the other person's behavior or how they related to you, whether it's early, middle, at the end, long term.
You mean like if they changed how they were with you?
Yeah.
Typically, middle to late, a lot of times they didn't change much because they'd already gotten used to my idiosyncrasies. Because, I did have autism, even though I didn't disclose it to them or didn't know about it. And so anytime I was likely to get into arguments with them or come into conflict and have things go wrong, they'd already seen that. So they'd already sort of learned how to work it out with me. So the kind of things that disclosure can help with, they'd spent 2 or 3 years working through. And I think disclosure, could have shortened that process, that, you wouldn't have had so much of a struggle to get through some of those things. So I think that sort of that's where the benefit of early disclosure is that it will change the way they interact with you. What you want is for it to change the way people interact with you for the better.
Yeah.
And that's the hope. But I think that early disclosure does have some benefits just because it sort of heads off in the past some of the worst things that can happen.
Okay, let's do the next question. Let's see, we have, it says here, I know someone who I think may be on the spectrum, but they haven't told me that they are. Can someone have autism and not know they have it?
Very easily.
I was just going to say that, yes. Definitely yes.
Yeah, no, it's quite possible to have autism and not know you have it. I had it until I was 23 and didn't know I had it. And the only reason I found out was a lucky article that made me think, hey, maybe I have autism. Let me go consult with some experts. So, yeah, it's pretty easy to have autism and not know you have it. Though, typically, if you don't know you have it, that usually means that in many cases you've sort of worked around it. Because once everything falls apart, then often you start asking, why are things falling apart? So, a lot of times, if you don't know you have it, you've worked out some coping mechanisms. And knowing you have it can be helpful. Knowing you have it can also throw your life out of line for a few years as you try to, compensate for what is relatively big news that honestly shouldn't be big news if you've reached adulthood and don't know you have it. It's significant, but at the same time, you've learned a lot of things that are helpful in your life. And the diagnosis means that you can learn new things, but you don't have to throw away anything you've already learned works for you.
That's a good point. Also, I was just thinking about this question because this question involves that they haven't told me that they are. Can someone have it and not know it? Now, it could be that they know and they're not disclosing it too. Some people aren't comfortable sharing that. But yes, definitely someone can have it and not know it. And yes, it's possible they have it and don't want to share it too. So if that's something that you see, in the community, those are possibilities. So, okay, Paul, here's another Paul question. This one says, Paul, I'm an adult on the spectrum. I have great difficulty with emotional and mental stamina in social situations. I often leave social interactions feeling exhausted and depressed. Has this happened to you? If so, what do you do to make these situations better?
Okay, so there's sort of a couple parts to this because, you know, there's the question of what do you do during, what do you do before, what do you do after. Before, you know, I try to make sure when I can that social things are spread out enough that I know I have recovery time between them and the other things I have going on. And that's really important is sort of learning how much energy you feel you can afford to spend on these things and how long you need to recover from them. And that's, you know, going to be difficult for everyone, but you don't have to do it now. You just need to improve it a little bit at a time, and eventually you'll get there. So, you know, being aware ahead of time that this is going to tire you out and saying, okay, so the next day, maybe I need to try to make sure I have nothing scheduled for the next day, or if I do have anything scheduled for the next day, it's all stuff I can do from the computer or whatever without having to leave the house to make sure that you have the recovery time. I found at such situations, it's really valuable if you have a friend who knows about your autism to have them around that, you know, in a social context like a party or a gathering of people or whatever, if you've got, you know, someone that you sort of can depend on, then if you're around them, you can often, like, if you're getting tired or whatever, either, you know, have them help out, take control of the conversation, fill in that, you know, when you're on your own, if you walk up to someone and you're talking with them, then you are responsible always for half of that conversation. But if you're with someone else and someone walks up to talk with you, they can chime in and give you a break and help you cool down, especially if they understand that you might need that. So having someone who knows about your condition there, obviously often more the better, but having someone along with you can really help, especially if you're going to be around new people or a lot of new people or things like that. As well, hopefully you can do this. This is often a challenging one, but don't be afraid to leave early. That, you know, once you learn that it does tire you out so much, don't leave when you start feeling tired. Leave before you start feeling tired, if you can. That you know that it's going to wear you out at some point, but, you know, plan to stay maybe only 30 minutes or an hour if it's, you know, like a dinner. Say, you know, once it's over, say, well, okay, guys, you know, I had a great time, but I've really got to get going. You don't necessarily have to give a reason to leave. And, you know, if you do have a reason, just say, you know, well, I'm feeling kind of tired. I've had a long day, and I really just need to go home and get some rest, something like that. That, you know, most people really are understanding of that sort of thing. You don't have to tell them you have autism. You don't have to tell them that this is stressing me out. That most people be like, oh, okay, you know, that's fine. And, you know, when you're on the autism spectrum, sometimes you feel like maybe they won't be like that because no one else is leaving, but they really will be. So don't be afraid to, you know, just leave as soon as you feel like it might be a good idea to leave. Once you've left, for me, I cool down by not doing anything. I'll read a book or, you know, watch a movie or something and just try to do things that don't require me to take any action. It's going to be different for everyone, but it's, you know, it's one of those things where you just find something that doesn't use your energy because you've just used up all of your energy. So find the things that use the least amount of your energy and just spend some time doing that and be okay with doing that. You know, that's one of the costs that comes with having autism is that these things are more tiring for us than they typically are for other people. And you can spend time worrying about, you know, I'm so tired by this, you know, what should I do? Or you can say, well, I'm always going to be tired by this, so let's just not waste any extra energy worrying about that part and just do whatever makes us feel better for a little while.
Okay. Well, let's take another short break, and when we come back, we will continue answering your questions about autism.
Money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
At Birenbaum and Spean PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Birenbaum and Spean works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
Ridenour, Heinsohn & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues, corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Ridenour, Heinsohn & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
Welcome back once again, everybody. This is the final segment of today's Understanding Autism. I'm Paul Levin. I'm here with Kim Isaac and Dave Isaac. Got it right again?
Woo-hoo. All right, here we are. All right, so these are, I think, very valuable questions, you know, because the general population probably doesn't know a whole lot about autism, and that's what makes this show so good, so valuable, so helpful, and relating to Paul's experiences as well as Kim's from the therapeutic side, which I think is just excellent. So, Kim, you probably have some more.
I do.
No one asked me a question? That's what I want to know.
All right. We still have time. You can post on our Facebook
yeah.
if you have anything for Dave.
Okay. Just kidding.
Okay. So, so Paul, this is a question from somebody to you. Do you have any relationship advice in terms of dating? This person says, I've had a great deal of difficulty meeting people, and I feel like my autism will keep me from having dating relationships.
So, the audience doesn't know this, but I've been in a relationship for quite a while. Actually, the audience may have heard me mention that I have a girlfriend. I really can't remember. But I have been in a relationship with someone for quite a while. We got together late 2010, So it's been, I guess, what, 3.5 years now?
That is a long time.
Oh,
that's good. That's a long time.
So it is possible.
Yeah.
But it is also a case. I'm very lucky. I have someone who is very understanding, and in a lot of ways she experiences things very similar to me. We both need a lot of space and alone time, and we both have similar paces in a lot of things that really help. And that's kind of what everyone wants in a relationship. But when you're on the autism spectrum, it can be a little harder to judge what you yourself need and what can make someone else happy. But the first step, he said he has difficulty meeting people. I'm afraid I can't offer any help there. I'm terrible about meeting new people. My friends have been moving away, you know, as life goes on. They get married, they go somewhere else to raise their kids, things like that. That, you know, I am losing friends just from that process faster than I'm making new friends. And I don't get out to meet new people. And it's very difficult. You know, a lot of times maybe you have work or hobbies or something that take you out into the world. You know, maybe you go to the quiz night at the pub. Maybe you play a sport or exercise at the gym or something where you run into new people. But even then, when you're on the autism spectrum, it can be a lot more difficult to take it from someone you see at the gym to someone you might actually hang out with. So even just making friends is difficult, let alone, you know, pursuing relationships and gauging when a relationship might be an option. So, and the truth is, for everyone, a lot of it depends on luck. That, you know, autism spectrum or no, finding the right person, really getting along with them, having it last longer than, you know, a few weeks or whatever, a lot of that comes down to luck. But it definitely is possible. Most of the relationships I've had have been fairly long, you know, that 6 months, year, more. And a lot of that is just finding, you know, people that you're comfortable with and are comfortable with you. And they're out there. But I can't offer any tips for finding them. I can just offer a little bit of hope that it really can work out. Just, you know, keep positive and, you know, try to be casual around people. That when you're seeking a real relationship, both friends and dating and romantic, you want someone who wants to spend time with you. You don't want someone who wants to spend time with a fake personality you put on or the facade you wear to try to convince people that you're, quote, normal in day-to-day life. You want them to be comfortable around you. And so part of that is letting them see who you are and get used to it and seeing how they react and explaining things when there are problems. So part of it, the very first step before you try to make friends, before you try to have a relationship, is to get comfortable with yourself. Understand who you are, who you really are, what autism means in your life. And from there, figure out, okay, now that I know who I am, I can show that to other people and see how it affects them. So I think that's the only real advice I can get is seek yourself before you seek others.
You know, that's so funny you said that, Paul. I have always said, be that which you seek. Similar. Yeah, be that what you seek. Because a lot of people say, I want someone like this, I want someone like this. You know, someone kind, compassionate, intelligent. Well, don't expect it from others if you can't have it yourself.
Or give it yourself.
Or I should say give it yourself.
Yeah.
But you can't give it unless you have it.
Right.
So it's very similar. That was good advice. Very nice advice.
That's the advice I give with the adults that I work with is a lot of times they haven't spent a lot, and understandably, like, they're lonely and they're getting older and they don't understand why certain things look easier for other people than them. Some of those things are their, you know, autism-related issues that they're attributing to who they are versus just difficulties that they have. So they might, you know, like, kind of over-personalize it. And I usually explain to people, you know, it's important that you learn about yourself.
Yeah.
So that you understand, you know, yourself. And I think that's a really, and not to mention it makes for a more solid, lasting relationship.
Well, let me ask Paul this. I mean, you didn't, you know, the diagnosis didn't come for you until age 23. Did you notice any more, it was probably a sense of relief, but also at that point, did it help you grow more as a person by knowing that?
I think it really did, because I think that it gave me the opportunity to ask the right questions about myself.
So that is so significant. That if you're in doubt, get a diagnosis because, right, you're just saying it now, that it could open up a whole new life, couldn't it?
It really can make a big difference. If you do have autism, knowing that you have it can really give you some confidence in certain areas that you may not have had before.
And I think some people, I've met adults who absolutely don't want the diagnosis because they've attributed the label factor. But as Paul's saying, and, you know, to give yourself an opportunity to learn more about yourself, once you have a diagnosis, you're able to, you know, take next steps that are going to make more sense for helping yourself than to try to randomly do things that,
The label is just a word. And the truth is a diagnosis about knowledge. If you get a diagnosis, that does not mean you have to tell a single other person on earth that you have it. It can be entirely your secret, but it still gives you the tools to find out more about yourself and to find out, you know, once you know you've got autism, you say, well, now I can look into how other people are coping with it. But if you don't know you have autism, you might look at the way other people cope with it and say, yeah, that doesn't sound right for me, even when it's something that you might think otherwise if you do have it. So it can really just change how you interpret some of the data you get.
I agree. So I think we have time for another question. This one I thought was interesting.
We're about 3 minutes.
Okay. All right, good. So we have time for this one. This person wants to know, does autism happen only in America?
And the answer to that is no. It's one of those things where it may seem like it happens at a higher rate in America because we talk about it more here. But I think I've heard that South Korea and Japan actually have pretty high rates of diagnosis.
Japan, I think, has the highest.
Now, does anyone know why that would be, Japan?
It may just, again, be cultural, that because their culture is, they have a saying that the nail that stands out is the first to be struck down. And it's saying basically that you need to get in line, that you have to behave a certain way. Japan has the concept of face where, you know, you have to show the proper respect to your manager, use the right suffixes when you talk to people. They have a very, very structured culture. And so because it's a structured culture, if someone doesn't fit into that culture, it becomes apparent very quickly that they're having a hard time adapting to the social pressure of the people around you because their culture is very much about social pressure and not stepping out of line. So I think that the diagnosis rate there might be high just because it's easier to spot people on the spectrum more than anything else. And I think that's the fact around the world is that we're probably going to find out that diagnosis rates are pretty similar in most of the world. There may be areas where it's higher because we have like higher heavy metal toxicity or other of the environmental factors that might cause it. But typically I think we're going to find out that on average it's about the same, and it's just the diagnosis rates that are differing from country to country as different cultures adapt and incorporate people on the spectrum in different ways. Some cultures may just incorporate them normally and not even think that there might be something wrong with them, so there's no autism there at all because no one's brought up the question yet, whereas other cultures, like Japan, it might stand out more.
Well, real quickly, before we end the show, I think this is very fascinating. Could it be the cultural beliefs and expectation that could create more autism or better diagnosis?
I think just better diagnosis.
Okay, gotcha. That's amazing. Can you believe the show has just zipped by, though?
That went by quickly.
This is fantastic.
And we'll definitely have to do this again sometime.
Definitely.
Yeah, a lot of questions.
Well, we still have some extra questions, but you know what? We could actually answer those. We have a few more that we
might bring up tomorrow if we have time.
We can bring them up tomorrow.
And what's the topic tomorrow, 3 to 4?
Tomorrow we're going to talk a bit about some of the common things those of us on the spectrum really would like people, neurotypical people, to understand about us.
That is excellent. Of course, from 2 to 3, we're going to have people in games. Gamification, that's going to be interesting.
I know it's a topic really exciting to you, so
we'll
get into that tomorrow from 2 to 3.
That's great. So this was Understanding Autism, Paul Alden, Kim Isaac, I'm Dave Isaac. Tune in tomorrow, 2 to 3, People in Games, Understanding Autism, 3 to 4, and everyone have a great night. Thank you.